Hello, everyone. It's another weekend, and that means it's another episode of the podcast. This week, I get to interview a delightful human being, Michael Cass. You should really check out Michael's website, storyandspirit.org, and I will provide a link under the episode show notes on the website. Michael says he's shifting consciousness one breath, one story at a time. And direct from Michael's website, he describes himself as an international facilitator, consultant, and healer who works with organizations and individuals to weave a new story that brings us into greater connection with ourselves, each other, and the wider world. And I've been really lucky because Michael's held one of his storytelling workshops at the place where I work, the coffee shop. And it was a special night and a group of strangers. I hate vulnerability, but at the end of the night, a group of strangers became really good friends. I can tell you that we shared stories about ourselves that made each other laugh, that made each other think, and it was just a beautiful experience. And so I'm so excited to share Michael with you all and his stories this week. I need to thank my good friend Christy Buddenbaum for becoming another Patreon subscriber. For those of you who are looking to help me put this podcast out into the world, there will be a link under the episode show notes. Just click on that link and you too can subscribe every month for either $3, $5, or $10 a month. Just know you're helping me to put beautiful content out into the world and know that I appreciate it so very much. So now, episode 119, and my interview with Michael Cass.
So I got on the land and I'm like, whatever, this is pretty. And I look down and I'm kind of like, what am I even here? I feel kind of out of place. And I look down at the ground and there is a perfectly intact snakeskin that a snake had just let go of. And I just, it floored me. I just went like, well, okay, this is real.
Who are you as a human being? If you were to go to a conference or go to a party and you have to introduce yourself, describe who you are, what you're made of. How would you introduce yourself to a group of people? Who are you?
It's a stumper. And the reason it's a stumper is because I honestly believe that we are inventing and being reinvented in every single moment. So like there's an essential core, which isn't necessarily a who, but more a what. And then the who is constantly shifting based on any number of factors. So if I were to answer it, I'll answer it the same way I do at a party, which is, who would you like me to be in this moment? Who would be of the greatest service to you? Do you need someone to listen? Do you need someone to talk about the vagus nerve and healing? But I think the more interesting question for me is always like, what are you? What is your soul? What are you doing here? And for me, What I always come back to, and I've had this sense ever since I was a kid, is like, I am someone who lives in multiple worlds and multiple streams of perception kind of simultaneously and can fully inhabit any one of those at any moment, right? And that gets a little bit stressful sometimes and also is an incredibly beautiful way to be. And so if I kind of think of the past 46 years, which would be from birth to now, it's been this constant iteration of again and again coming to terms with this idea that there's very little linearity to my beingness. And so that shows up, has shown up in the work that I do, that has shown up in the way that I listen deeply to others. It's shown up in the kind of work I find myself drawn to. It definitely showed up when I was an actor for many, many years. And one of the reasons I was an actor is because the stage was one of the few places where it actually felt safe to be fully inhabiting different realities and to be able to be in deep relationship with other people while inhabiting those realities. To go back to the original question, which I have not yet answered, which is, who are you as a human? I would just say a storyteller, right? A weaver of all of these different threads, with the added layer of hopefully the weaving of those threads is of service in some way.
So when you say that time or experience is nonlinear, do you mean that things are circular, like how Indigenous societies speak of, you're already nodding yes. So I think, how did you come to that realization?
It was pushed on me. I didn't want to, because I grew up, going back to the idea of story, steeped in story. And right, in our culture, story is so linear. It's the dumbed down version of the hero's journey, which is, you know, in drama, you have Freytag's pyramid, which is you have a setup and then there's a climbing action and a climax. And then, it, you know, it all gets better at the end. But over and over again, what I've found and kind of lived into is this idea that you keep having versions of the same experience over and over and over again. And in Western culture, that can feel like you're stuck. But it's actually a spiral, right? And so you're iterating and iterating on different themes and different questions and different opportunities again and again and again. And in my mind, it's moving both inwards towards that which is essential and outwards from that which is essential all the time in this kind of ever expanding and ever contracting at the same time spiral, if you can envision that. But yeah, that's a very Indigenous way of being, which was a huge relief to me when I started studying that. I'm like, oh, this makes much more sense than everything I was educated into. It just kind of clicked in almost at a cellular level that, oh, this fits. And everything that I'd learned around like linearity and kind of a entrainment away from systemic or ecosystemic thinking, that never fit, that never felt right. But when I started studying these older ways of being, it just, something in my body knew it.
Totally going to go off on a side tangent here, but you were talking about, you know, most story or drama or plays, movies, they have the beginning of a problem, the journey of the hero, the conflict, and then the resolution. You know, that's a very basic summary right there. But I was just thinking about Shakespeare. And do you feel the same thing about Shakespeare? Because I feel like some of Shakespeare's plays at the end, yes, there is a little resolution, but it's very disquieting. And you always feel like in some of them, like the characters are just starting out on their journeys, but the story ends. Does that make sense to you? It's like everyone goes through their journey in a play that Shakespeare writes, but then at the end, you feel that only half of the story is told. Does that make sense to you? And that
absolutely.
Some of, okay.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, right, I love Shakespeare so much. And I think one of the reasons is you can kind of open a Shakespeare play or read any verse in Shakespeare and there's like hidden depths underneath it, right? Of metaphor and analogy and all of these things. And in my mind, I love that we're talking about this because there's a few things going on. One is Shakespeare or whoever wrote Shakespeare's plays was a genius and just had this intuitive sense. The other thing that I think is really important is to consider the context he was writing for. People didn't just sit there and watch a play. They were actively engaged. They were yelling at the stage, right? It was this whole rowdy happening. And in order to keep people engaged, you have to have all of these multiple threads and people coming in and people leaving and there's no resolution, almost like a festival performance, more than what we would think of as a Shakespeare play, which is generally fairly stodgy. Right. And so I think one of the reasons he wrote the way he did was for that, right? To keep people's interest and to keep it a little bit more dynamic and interactive.
Two questions. What's your favorite Shakespeare play? Mine is The Tempest. Two, what's the favorite, like your most favorite character you've acted or brought to life?
So my most favorite Shakespeare play is Macbeth. And the reason is that we spent months studying it in high school and like parsed almost every passage of text and really found all the images. It's also Shakespeare's shortest play, right? It's just the most densely constructed, the richness of the characters, the language, all of it. Love it so much. The favorite character that I ever played when I was doing stage things. Well, there were two. I'm going to cheat and say two. One is the professor in Oleana, which is a David Mamet play. So if folks don't know it, it's like it was hugely controversial. There's two characters. There's a professor and a student. And it would never play now, but it was written, I don't know, 20 something years ago. And I loved it because I was 25 when I was in it, and I was playing a 40 something or late 30 something year old professor and trying to find the sympathy for this character, who's honestly kind of a horrible human being, and to really immerse myself in that character's point of view was such an incredible opportunity and challenge. And it was really fun to do that. And then the other one was Sergeant Trotter in The Mousetrap, which I won't spoil why that character's fun, but it was super fun.
So listen, did you grow up in a religious household, or how did you come upon this worldview or cosmology?
Did not grow up in a religious household. Both my parents are Jewish. Judaism was not really, I went to temple and Hebrew school on the weekends, but it was never something that was like embraced wholeheartedly. And so there was always kind of a push-pull with it. And the religion or the Judaism that I was brought up with was not very interesting in that it had been stripped of all of its spirituality and really came off as more like a bunch of rules and regulations without any explanation as to why we should care, right? And so as a kid, and this is come to find out very, very common among American Jews who grew up in like the 80s, which is when I grew up, is this just sense of like, this is not relevant, totally disaffected, right? So that was not a very large part of my upbringing at all. My mother was kind of like actively pushing against any kind of religious ritual or ceremony. My father was a little bit more down with it. But yeah, it was never, I actually grew up, even though my family was Jewish, I grew up going to a lot because of the neighborhoods I grew up in, like Baptist, Southern Baptist churches, where I found like so much more energy and so much more spirit. Even though I didn't have those words for it as a kid, I just thought it was fun, right? And so it was kind of interesting to get to experience both of those worlds.
They're very different.
They are very different, in fact. Yeah, I remember, so I got bar mitzvahed. I grew up in Washington, D.C., but my bar mitzvah was in Detroit. And the reason it was in Detroit is my grandfather was there and he was like sick. He couldn't travel. But I didn't know anybody at my bar mitzvah, right? This huge, supposed to be a rite of passage, traditional thing of like being accepted by your tribe is like this new human. I knew like five people there, right? It was so not interesting. But the day after, we went to my mother knew the preacher. I'm trying to remember exactly how this happened. My mother knew the preacher of a church in Detroit, and we went just to experience it. And they announced me right? As we were the only white people there, and they were like, when I introduce, you know, our friends from out of town, and this is Michael, he just had his bar mitzvah, it's a very big deal in Jewish tradition, and everybody was like congratulating me. And, you know, at the time I was just mortified, but looking back, I'm like, they were so welcoming. They were so excited by the fact that, oh, this young man is amongst us now. And it was such a weirdly, deeply contrasting experience from the actual rite of passage or initiation, which didn't feel like much of anything other than an empty gesture.
Gosh, I can't even imagine that. I mean, I do have to admit that I don't have, I've been mostly non-religious my whole life, more spiritual, and I have pretty much almost no knowledge of what a bar mitzvah looks like. But I do have the understanding, based on what little research I've done, that it is a big time for family and the community to get together to welcome the young person. And, you know, kind of enfold them into the community, like in a more, concrete way, I guess. Let's use that word. So it's interesting that you had that. What a dissonant experience to have this really sacred, this sacred moment. But it wasn't with your quote unquote tribe. It was mostly strangers. How interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. And it wasn't even lost on me at the time that this was happening, because it was, you know, my grandmother invited all of her people from Detroit who I didn't know, even though they were technically extended family. And yeah, I mean, you're exactly right, because a bar mitzvah is the moment where a young person grapples and gets woven in to the ongoing mythic story of Judaism as portrayed in the Torah, right? That's why you read from the Torah. It's not just to read, but it's to like enter into conversation with it and to offer an analysis based on your little 13-year-old mind and whatever questions it has, right? And then to have that be witnessed and celebrated, and then, you know, lifted up by your community, to have that happen in a place I wasn't like, and it was in a, you know, a hotel ballroom, small hotel ballroom, you know, there was no juice to it. There was no spiritual energy to it.
Question. How many of your grandmother's friends or family were in the mob? Because they were from Detroit.
Oh, no, that they were mostly from Canada. Like they had immigrated over from Canada. So they weren't there. I mean, not that I know of. There are no family legends of like closet mob or mafia people in the family. That's funny. I'm like, what? Are you at? Oh, that kind of makes sense. But no, they were just like first. They had come over from Eastern Europe in like the late 1800s. So before things got weird in like Germany and those areas. I don't think they were part of that world.
Well, I was going to say that even Canadians can be mobsters. I mean, I know everybody thinks Canadians are very polite and very sweet, thoughtful. They ride horses. They're very kind. And I think they wear a lot of chaps and stuff like that, but they can be mobsters as well.
That is a really good point. And I will now make it a point to look into my family history and see if there's secret mobbiness there. In a way, Canadians would be the perfect mobsters because nobody would think about even the possibility.
That's so true. Going back to, here's a question. Sometimes I get these questions. So I don't know if you feel like Old Testament Judaism, the Old Testament, is more linear, whereas for me, like the Kabbalah and that kind of esoteric Judaism is more circular, more I don't know, more the way you were talking about spiraling in on itself, seeking for answers. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the essentially, Jews were tribal indigenous people. They wandered around, right? And if you look at the pre-Old Testament texts, in a lot of ways, like, the Old Testament is calcified spirituality. Somebody needed to took it upon themselves to set this down and then to make a lot of laws and rules. But if you look at the kind of Kabbalistic thought or Jewish mysticism, kind of like Sufism, kind of like Christian mysticism, they all have this deeply embedded indigenous worldview, right? Which is the spiral instead of the line, which is animistic, right? Which does have a cosmology that is not dualistic at all, right? And doesn't really have a omnipotent conscious being that made everything. There's more like an energy of creation in all of these traditions that is not reflected in the kind of religious texts as most of us grew up with them, for sure.
And I think there's also the sense that you as the individual can approach, you know, the sacred, can approach that energy, can approach that beingness on your own, in that you don't need the, you know, an emissary in the form of a priest, such as like is in Catholicism. You can do it on your own, you know, which can be dangerous. It can be dangerous to approach that sacred presence, that divine presence on your own, but it's also life-changing for you. It can be completely life-changing to do it on your own.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things that's a little wild about what's happening kind of right now in spirituality, which is kind of the emergence of I'm spiritual, not religious, is you have a lot of people like having their first experiences of that, of spirit, right? Of the numinous in containers that are super weird, right? And so either they're doing it on their own and they get lost because it's profoundly disorienting, right? To come into communication with that for the first time and go like, whoa, nothing, everything's different. Or to come into communication with it in a container that is oriented towards super weird power dynamics. And yet there are maps that have been around for hundreds of thousands of years telling us how to do this stuff in a good way. And it's not hard. It just requires listening and respect. Yeah, I'm just remembering like the experience. I've been very fortunate that most of my experiences, all of them have been in like really beautiful containers, both traditional and not traditional. Like for me, it's always been really beautiful. But in some of my one-on-one work with people, I meet people who've been deeply damaged, not necessarily by their encounters with spirit or the divine or whatever word we want, but by the way that they were introduced to it.
I really appreciate and love you bringing maps and cartography into the language that we're using, because first of all, I think maps are amazing. And I remember in fourth grade, I had to do a detailed report on the state of Illinois. Thank you. And we had to have four or five different kinds of maps that we had to draw out ourselves of Illinois. You know, one was topographical. I can't remember. Another one was of rivers and lakes. We had to do all these different kinds of maps. And I'd never understood before that, oh, wow, there are lots of different ways to kind of parse out a landscape or understand a landscape. And so you using that cartographic, that map making, that map language is so interesting to me, because I would suspect that for each person, the map looks different, which is kind of blows my mind. It makes me super excited. Maybe the map isn't even two-dimensional, or maybe it's three-dimensional. Maybe it's an object. Maybe it's a path. You know, it's super exciting. Thank you. You just kind of blew my mind there.
You are so welcome. Well, and I love that idea that you brought in of like the map isn't the territory, right? It's a way of sense making. So you can make sense of a landscape through topography, right? Changes in altitude by the presence of bodies of water. I think one of the things that I see a lot is people read a map, right? They watch a TED talk. They read a book by, you know, some spiritual leader, and then they think they understand the thing, because they've looked at the map, So clearly now they've been on the landscape and they've been on the territory, but they don't have the embodied knowledge, right? Like, we've never lived in a time where there are more maps available to us. And I feel like we've never lived in a time where people are more disconnected from the landscape itself. Oh shit, there's two that come up. One just happened this weekend. So I facilitate this thing called Inner Dance, which is a really beautiful, I think we've talked about it a little bit, but it's this beautiful experience of just being of surrender to different frequencies of sound, and you get taken on this journey. And the really kind of magical thing that happened this weekend is I facilitate these online, and the people who participate don't really know each other, and they're in all over the place, all over the world. And this weekend, out of six people, four of them experienced almost identical images, and they showed up in each other's journeys. Part of me, like, I know that this is a thing, right? I've had enough experiences of it myself. But every time it happens, and every time I watch people's eyes light up with the recognition that we are all connected in this way, if only we remember how to listen, is such a magical moment. It's like the clouds part and there's heavenly voices, right? It's just such a commonplace miracle. There's nothing weird about it. It's just this really beautiful thing that we have all have the capacity to do, right? These aren't like super meditators. They're not super spirit. They're just curious. It is so beautiful that we got to experience that together. And the other one, which is different but also similar, was like 6 years ago, I participated in this healer's intensive in Topanga, California. This woman named Dina Metzger, who's an incredible teacher and elder and writer, artist, has been holding this group on her land, or on the land that she stewards, for like 20 years or something. And so I went, and I was in a place not unlike I am now, honestly, where I just like something wanted to change. I didn't know what it was. Things didn't feel like they fit right. And one of the first things that we did, and she, you know, we all went around, introduced ourselves, and she goes, okay, now go out on the land for an hour and then bring back a story, right? See what the land has to tell you. So I got on the land and I'm like, whatever, this is pretty. And I look down and I'm kind of like, what am I even here? I feel kind of out of place. And I look down at the ground and there is a perfectly intact snakeskin that a snake had just let go of. And I just, it floored me. I just went like, well, okay, this is real, right? It was the perfect message and reflection for what I was experiencing in that moment. If I could have walked right by it, it blended in with the ground. But the idea that it was there at that moment, while I was holding that question, and that I was looking down at that moment to see it and didn't step on it and didn't pass it by, is such a, again, just a small common miracle that, and telling the story now, I'm wondering, well, how many of those do we all walk by every day just because we're not paying attention? And those to me are much more interesting than like the capital M miracles or capital M magic of like healings and, you know, presences that are there. Like, those are cool, but I'm really interested in those small miracles that everybody has and often doesn't even recognize. We don't even recognize them until we're sharing it with someone else and they go like, what? That's crazy.
I have to tell you that it's your second story is so interesting to me because I was listening to you, okay? I want you to know that I was listening to you, but I was also thinking about, you know, since I've been coming on this trip, I have a lot of questions about my life and I'm trying to figure out a direction to go. And, you know, the snake is a symbol of change and transformation and rebirth. I'm sure you know this already. And today I went out to this park and was walking around. And as you're telling this story about going out on the land, it kind of made me think about earlier today when I went out to this park and I was walking around, then all of a sudden I just thought, I'm going to sit down right here on this bench. And I was sitting on the bench for just, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds. And I turned my head to the right. And out of this culvert, a gray snake came out. I would say it came about halfway out of the culvert and poked its head up and just looked around. Apparently did not see me, who was sitting less than 3 feet away from it. I was thinking, oh, that's a cool looking snake. And I wonder if it's dangerous. You know, just kept looking around and then it just kind of went down on the ground. And I was thinking, I'm not going to move. And then it just went back under the culvert. And I thought, the snake's always been a really powerful image for me, a really powerful animal. I mean, I see them all the time, even in New Mexico. It's very strange. So you're starting to tell your story. And I immediately went back to what happened this morning. And both of our stories are about snakes. And I thought that was very interesting.
That is interesting. I mean, there's a beautiful thing with stories, because I didn't know I was going to share that story until I started sharing it. And so there's a beautiful thing with stories is they call each other forth. When I work with people on their story and they start by saying, I need to learn how to tell my story, the first thing I say is like, that's not a thing. What we can do is like listen for the story that wants to be shared and then build our capacity for sharing it. But we can't, in the same way that like those religious texts crystallize something that's intrinsically dynamic, we do the same thing with our stories. There's a cool thing about snakes. Can I geek out on snake for a little bit? So there's like the snake symbolism, but then there's also the biology of the snake and the way that the snake sheds their skin, which is all at once. And the reason that they do it all at once, and this is so cool, is because there could be parasites that the old skin has. And so if they do it a little bit at a time, those parasites, right, can get infested. And so they do it all at once, not because it's fun, but out of like biological necessity and like supporting their lives. And I think so much about the way we in our culture tend to do transformation, which is like this tortured process of like, oh, just a little bit of a time. And what are the energetic parasites that get left behind in that process that we then have to go back and go like, oops, there's one. I think snake has so much to teach us about how to do things. Just, oops, the skin no longer fits. Now we're done. And then it's like raw and uncomfortable for a little while.
Takes me back to Shakespeare and Hamlet, who, yes, might go a little bit mad, but achieves a lot of transformation in a very short amount of time.
Yes. Yeah, but he also has, like, if he were to fully embody the snake, there would be the moment where he can kill Claudius and he would just do it. But there's, right, that whole monologue. And the whole thing of like, do I do it? Do I not do it? Who am I? What am I? Snake would never do that. Snake would just go like, oh, here's the thing. Oh, now I'm this. But I think it's I think one of the reasons Hamlet continues to resonate through the centuries is like, we've all had that. Where it's like, I know the thing I need to do. It's probably not killing my uncle. Right. It might be quitting the job. It might be leaving the relationship. It might be going to school, like whatever. I know the thing, but do I do it? Do I not do it? Oh, who am I if I don't? Who am I if I do? Like, that's such a universal thing. I'm going to weave one more thread in. That the reason I think we get hung up is that we don't have supported rites of passage and initiations in our culture, because the whole purpose of those is to meet us in those moments of like knowing what the next thing is, or at least the next step, and not being able to take it. And then the initiation meets us there and says like, let's go, let's cross that threshold.
I love that you end with something so eloquent, because all I was going to say was, it's so good that Shakespeare didn't write a play with a snake as the main character, because it would be a really short play.
So short. Very little drama.
Very little drama. The snake would just change and it'd be over. I guess it could be the preview of the actual play. It could be like the short preview.
The short preview, right? Yep. Just to engage people. And they go, that sucks. And then Hamlet comes out and gets angsty. They go, like, that feels right.
Yes, exactly. Perfect. Yes. Now we know why Shakespeare didn't use snakes. Thank you. We've solved one of the world's greatest mysteries.
Scholars today have been puzzling over that for centuries. And look, centuries. We figured it out.
You all can tell that he and I had such a great time recording this interview, and it's really fun talking about so many different subjects with someone who can appreciate every single one of them. I need to thank Michael for his sense of humor and just for what a delightful human being he is, and the fact that he took time out of his very busy schedule to appear on the pod. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode: Taiga Sound Productions, Stephen O'Brien, Music L Files, Frank Schroeder, Winnie the Moog, Sasha End, and Alexander Nakarada. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to books, music, and art. I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request: be like Michael. Be super cool and help others find out what their stories are. Think about your own story. What is it? Or think about your stories. We all have multiple stories, whether it's about ourselves or it's about the greater world around us. Share those stories with others and listen to other people's stories. Sharing these stories is going to help us relate to each other, develop compassion and empathy for each other, and also help us to realize that we are far more connected and far more similar than we probably previously understood. Thank you so much, and see you all next week for episode 120. And until then, I hope your days are shiny, your life is beautiful, and everything is filled with laughter and love. Was that a yawn?
No.
Okay, my guests are not allowed to yawn.
I'm not yawning. I don't know what you think you thought you saw, but it wasn't that. It was like I'm taking in all of the air and energy in the world.
Okay. Clearly someone needs to go to bed soon. So no, let's.
I'm good. It's not even nighttime.
Well, sometimes I go to sleep when it's not nighttime. So no,
but that's, you can't do that.
I love it. It's part of being an adult. Go to sleep when you want.
Damn straight.